So I'd like to think that I would have been one of those people. I don't know if I'd have been Lady Gaga, but I would have been, you know, somebody who like, oh, this is awesome. And hopefully I'd had the skills to stand out. We saw Elon Musk destroy Twitter.
Yeah.
He had amazing product sense he had developed around aeronautics, around electric cars, but that did not help him with Twitter.
So that gives me hope that our discipline will still be needed in a couple of years.
So I have a lot of hope that the discipline is, but not as it's practiced in most of Europe. In general, though, I don't talk about myself too much just because I don't think anybody'd be interested.
Moin from Hamburg and welcome to season 2 of Produktmenschen, the podcast that meets the people behind our products. I am Tobias Freudenreich, an independent product leadership coach and co-founder of Hey Clarity. My guests in this podcast work in product management, design, or engineering. They lead or coach product people or entire product organizations. I want to get to know them, understand what they are passionate about, where they want to go next, and why they ended up in product in the first place. 4 years have passed since the last episode of the first season. These 11 conversations, all recorded in German, are still available if you would like to listen to them again. Over the years, many of you have repeatedly asked me about the podcast, so I couldn't really break my promise and had to release another season. And within the blink of an eye, the time has come. Here we are. This season has an overarching theme: intuition. What shapes it? When does it help us? When does it get in our way? And how is its significance changing in the age of AI? Today's episode was recorded during this year's Product at Heart conference in Hamburg. If you want to be part of the next edition of that outstanding event, the ticket pre-sale started today. So better be fast and grab your ticket at productatheart.com. To kick off the new season, I'm joined by a truly remarkable guest and I'm already excited to receive your feedback. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a 5-star rating, and share it with someone who might appreciate it as well. You can also subscribe to the Produktmenschen newsletter at produktmenschen.de. And if you have feedback or suggestions, I would love to hear from you at feedback@produktmenschen.de. And now, without further ado, let's dive into today's episode.
Hi, I'm Sean Russell.
I'm Arne Kittler.
And I'm Tobias Freudenreich.
Together, we are Hey Clarity. We help company leaders build strong product organizations. Find out how we can help you at hey-clarity.com. And now, enjoy today's episode.
What the Beatles are to music, Michelangelo is to art, and the Kardashians are to reality TV, that's what my guest today is to product management. By now, most of you probably know who I'm talking about. But for those unfamiliar with the works of the Beatles, Michelangelo, or the Kardashians, let me just mention the titles of his 3 books: Inspired, Empowered, and Transformed. And we all hope there will be many years to come before he ever starts writing Retired. Yes, I'm talking about the founder of the Silicon Valley Product Group. And today I want to find out, has his career always been a straight line to where he is now? You might think so, just looking at his initials, MC, because he is truly the MC of product. I'm deeply honored to welcome you to the Produktmenschen podcast. Hello, Mr. Marty Kagan.
Hello. Thanks very much.
Hello. Nice having you, Marty. To warm up, I would like to start with a few quick sentence completions. And I would ask you to answer as quick and as intuitively as possible. There is no right or wrong answers, just whatever comes to mind first. Are you ready?
Okay, but I'll warn you, I spend most of my time coaching people to think and not to do that. So if I end up thinking before I give you an answer, it's not my fault.
Yeah, I guess we can take that risk. So are you ready?
Sure.
The biggest myth about product work is...
See, that's not easy. Probably that it's a role in a process.
Mm-hmm. That leads me to the second one. Process people are to me...
Well-intentioned, but very damaging.
AI will change the importance of intuition to...
Thinking.
The SAFe framework is...
Waterfall.
The intuition of most leaders is...
Well, the intuition of good product leaders with good product sense is quite good. The intuition of product leaders with no product sense is no good.
In 10 years, AI will, just to put an easy one at the end.
We'll have changed virtually everything we do.
Yeah, wonderful. So thank you very much. As you might have recognized, there were some questions around the topic of intuition, which will be, and that's a difference to the first season of the podcast, the leading theme for all the interviews. So I want to figure out what intuition is and how it comes to play in product management. And yeah, we're going to touch ground on that particular topic a bit later in the show. Before that, I would want to get to know you because the podcast is more about the people behind the products. And many of us might feel that we know you very well, that we know your thinking, your principles, your values, because we follow your writing, your talks, and your work. But what's maybe a bit surprising is how little we actually know about you as a person, about you personally. Apart from the story where you drove a pregnant colleague's wife to the hospital and somehow ended up in the local newspaper as the baby's father, there's hardly anything out there. I wanted to ask you if that's a conscious choice. Like, do you prefer to let your ideas speak for themselves, or are there other reasons behind keeping your personal life so private?
Honestly, I don't think it is very private. I tell several stories that were influential in my life in the books. One of the really important things that led me to what I do is my father, who was a professor of computer science and a PhD in computer science. And so I dedicated one of the books to him and told that because he taught me to program at 7 years old. Today, that's not so uncommon. But when I did it, it was very, very uncommon and super lucky for me. So I told about that story. I told about sort of what led me into product. And in general, though, I don't talk about myself too much just because I don't think anybody'd be interested. That's all.
I don't think so. Let's see. I guess we're going to have many downloads of that episode and people will be very interested. So let me start with a very personal question, maybe. What do you smell the moment you feel at home?
Well, I live in the mountains, and so I'd probably say the mountains.
The mountains. What do mountains smell like?
Well, it's very high altitude where so I live.
Clear and fresh air.
2,500 meters up. So the air is very crisp and dry.
We are recording in Hamburg, and the weather outside is like... Yeah. Freezing nearly, and we call it summer. Yeah. Before we dive into your career, I'd like to rewind even a bit more. And I'd love to learn what shaped the way you think and lead or led before you founded the Silicon Valley Product Group. I want to go far to the past and want you to think about your childhood. You mentioned your father and his role studying computer science in the end. But when you think about your childhood, how would you describe it in three words?
Three word part makes it hard, but and it was typical child of a teacher in a typical sort of American Californian family. Nothing really special, but I remember the definitive thing as far as, I mean, I played sports every day, and I was actually, maybe I haven't told this, but I paid my way through college as a coach, as a tennis coach.
Mm, yeah.
So I was very into sports before, but I learned to program at 7. So I was programming, and that gave me great job opportunities, even before college, just by doing little things for businesses that my father knew. And so it was a good way to make some money. And then I knew what I wanted to do in college. I wanted to program.
Would you say that because you did that so early already, like programming and also making some money with programming, you learned a lot about the business case behind it already, like at this age, or was it more like fun and I'm lucky to get some money?
It was fun and I was lucky to get some money. My father, who was really, he was literally the first PhD in computer science in the US.
Oh, wow.
So he was like very early, but he was terrible at business.
Okay.
Just terrible. He had no interest in the business. He was interested in the pure engineering side. Mm. And so I think I was a little bit of both. I saw the limitations of just knowing the engineering, but I also saw how much fun the engineering was. So I think I was more open to the business side. But I know for a fact that I didn't pursue that because I didn't have a single finance class in college. So not a single one. So I realized later how that was not smart. I should have had a business, a finance class at least, but I didn't. So I had to learn that later.
Yeah, but I guess that's something you can learn on the job, right?
You can learn. I would say, though, I was most interested in just building things. I like to program and I like to build. I thought, programming is a very creative act. I think it's not a coincidence that I write so much books and articles because it's also creative.
Is that what excited you the most back then about programming?
Or? Building things,
building things.
Love building things.
Were there other hobbies where you built things, like, I don't know, remote controlled planes or something?
No,
like
not
that?
Really. Because especially it was just exactly at the time these things were becoming possible to program. There was literally the first programming language to program robots. Mm. And I learned that language and I got to control a very primitive robot. That was just fun. But today, of course,
it's Lego Mindstorms today.
Today is, orders of magnitude more advanced.
Yeah, but also further away from the roots and from understanding what's going on underneath the hood, right?
True. But I think the abstractions help much more than they hurt.
Yeah, so you don't fear that people don't know any longer.
And I used to discuss this with my father because he learned starting with the cables, the connections, the tubes. He learned at that level, and he learned like before calculators with slide rules and he was. But he was like, yeah, I'm so glad I don't have to waste time on that anymore. And I don't. I don't feel like I needed to learn that. I did learn assembly language, which not even a lot of people don't even know what that is anymore, but it was at the lowest level you do. Yeah. But most, a lot of people are too young for that. They consider like a language like Java or even C as a very low level language. But I learned at that level, but I don't think I ever even used it once.
Yeah.
In building products.
Yeah, I remember that I programmed a mouse driver because I wanted to have a digital darts board, which my parents didn't want to buy. And so I had to program something and I had a graphical interface where you could click. Like the plan. And therefore I needed a mouse driver, which had to be built in assembler. But I think I just copied from a book, like where you had to type, like there were books with, like, I remember 10 pages of code, which you just had to type. And when there was one mistake, it's like, yeah, stories from the past, right?
Yes.
Luckily, this one is a story from the past. So if you could travel back in time and let's say could travel back to the time where you've been 10 years old and you would visit your younger self, what do you think? Would he be proud of what you had achieved today, or would he be confused or surprised?
I don't know. I think at 10 years old, I thought I was going to be a professional tennis player, so I probably would be surprised.
Yeah, okay.
Because at 10 years old, I don't think you have a very good judge of the world.
And let's say at 15 years old, you were already thinking about making a career in software development?
Yes, I think I was.
So there were not these astronauts, firefighters, no. Police officer dreams of a
not a
quote-unquote normal child. So would you say that you've been a nerd?
I did. Like I said, I played sports heavily every day. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of both on the... I love science and I love the engineering side of things. But I also was just, you know, I spent most of the days...
So you had a 10, you had a social life, you had friends. You were not that kind of kid sitting in the basement just in front of a computer screen.
Right. Okay. Kind of did both.
And when we hear in Germany, like somebody grew up in California, we imagine a life at the beach surfing. Yeah. But you've not been into surfing?
Not really. It's just socially I lived by the beach. So,
but yeah. Wonderful. So let's maybe move on a bit further into your career. Like you already told us, you studied computer science. And I want to talk a bit about your path from being an engineer to becoming one of the most influential product voices out there. Was that a journey as straight as it looks from the outside or in hindsight?
No, I don't think it was straight. And I wrote about this and I think it was inspired that I got pulled in the product like a lot of engineers get pulled in the product because...
Even these days.
But it's forever. I think it's always been the case.
Yeah.
As you know, product people come from all over, everywhere. But many come from engineering. And I had really focused on engineering, and my goal was actually career goal was to be a co-founder of a startup as an engineering leader, which I did. I was the CTO of a startup, but I realized garbage in, garbage out, as we say. So you realize that engineering is not enough. Hmm. You need to understand what you're building. I also got a good appreciation for you have to make sure that other people can understand how to use this product, not just the people. Of course, the people who build it know how to use it. They built it, so they know exactly how to use it. But people who didn't build it often think about things very differently, and you learn the importance of design, and you learn the importance of product. If you don't have a way to get your product into the hands of customers, if it doesn't also satisfy the business needs, it's not enough for just the customers to love it. So I got a deeper appreciation by doing 10 years of products on the engineering side for how important product management and design were. The truth is, for my entire career, I have never considered myself just for product management. Mm. My interest has always been product teams. Mm. It's always been product teams. And I don't really care what the titles are. I just care that you have these skills on a team. It is true, though, that there are so many good resources for engineers, so many good ones for designers, but especially for most of my career, there was very little for product people.
Yeah.
Very little.
Yeah.
Really almost nothing for product managers. And the stuff that was there was from the consumer packaged goods industry, mm-hmm. which is a very different thing. It's about pricing and packaging and promotions. It's really closer to what we call product marketing. Mm. And so there was almost nothing. And that, I found myself spending more time helping on my own staff, you know, on my own people, helping the people responsible for the product management side of things, because so many of them had never learned the craft.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty interesting, because I also feel when discussing with people who read your books, which many of the people I do discuss in my daily work with have, there is this misconception that because you write about product leadership, that you are just referring to the product managers, so people who are leading product managers. But I remember from a discussion we had in London that you explicitly said, like, no, with product leadership, I mean at least UX design, engineering, and product management.
Yes.
Yeah, that's oftentimes a confusion, because we cut things short too often. And so people confuse product with product management and confuse the role with the actually team sport, which is building products.
And especially, you know, they're just language differences. In Europe, many people use the term product leader for an individual contributor product manager.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other. It's like, once I figured that out, I remember being so confused when I said, what are you talking about? You
know, yeah, let's not discuss titles in organizations. It's a mess, right?
It's a mess. And I'm like, well, you have to be clear. It's a very different job to actually build, to do product management versus lead product manager. Yeah. So those are different jobs. And once I understood there was that confusion, I was able to clarify it, at least with in my own work, in my own writing. So, but you know, different parts of the world, there are these different issues that pop up, and that just happens to be one of them that's been an issue.
I guess you've learned a lot about these differences because your books are being read all over the globe. But let's maybe for a moment, again, go back to like where everything has started. I mean, basically, you've been part of shaping the early internet, first at Netscape, then at eBay, two places that defined what digital products could be in the end. And for the younger ones listening back then, we all couldn't even imagine that a browser other than Netscape would ever have a chance. So looking back, was that when your core product philosophy started to emerge? Like, were there moments or patterns that shaped your beliefs? Like, where did they come from?
It was actually before the internet. The internet happened in the mid-1990s, but during the late 1980s is when I realized that engineering was not enough. And so I was very, you know, so much is luck. But there was a person who was an extremely strong product leader, real product leader. He had started four different businesses, successful $100 million businesses. And he agreed to coach me and teach me product management. And I was just an engineer. I had done engineering leadership also by then, but I didn't know anything about it, and he agreed to coach me. And that happened before the internet happened. In fact, I think that's probably why I got the job at Netscape, because I was an engineer that had all of this, had some other skills. And that was, I mean, there was, Netscape was a very intense and, you know, iconic example of many, many products very quickly. So it's very similar to what we're experiencing right now with OpenAI sort of being at the center of the generative AI ecosystem. Well, Netscape was at the center of this emerging internet ecosystem. And so it was every day there were products we were building, and there were products others were building that were meant to work with those products. And it was wild. Every single day was changes.
I can imagine it was exactly the time when I started programming my first websites and made some money with that back in school. And yeah, Netscape 4.7, if I remember correctly, that was like the standard. And you had to discuss like if you should even optimize for Internet Explorer because it's not relevant at all and nobody would expect a company like Google to emerge and then like taking over the browser business. So yeah. It was really, really a defining product at these days. Like the internet was Netscape.
It was, but that was very, very early. You know, that was very early yeah. in the internet. And so, you know, many things developed. In fact, Chrome, the original developers on Chrome came from Netscape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the person that inspired you in the 80s, I guess that was back in HP, right?
Yeah, it was.
And was it that you'd say you got trained in how to fill this like missing role, like the product role, something like that? Or is it that you just thought for yourself?
No,
like how should that be done? Or?
There wasn't really training.
There were no role models, right?
Well, there was role models. There has always been role models for this, but they were only in very, you know, small number of companies. You have to remember back then the industry was very small and all in one city, basically Palo Alto.
Yeah.
They were all in the heart of what is Silicon Valley.
I guess some people would argue for Seattle as well, right?
I mean, back then, not really Seattle. They would have said Boston.
Yeah. Okay.
But there was, okay, small, but they were still a small number of companies. And some of those companies were building amazing products like the original Macintosh or if you remember, like the PDP-11 from mm-hmm. Digital Equipment was a very important computer at the time. And that was out of Boston. And so there were amazing products. And behind all of those products were some pretty sophisticated product people. Now, I mentioned I was lucky because I had one of these people. His name was Mike Bacco. He was not my manager. My manager was an engineering VP, so he didn't know how to coach me on product, but he knew him and he asked him to coach me. And that's what he did. It was not hard. It took him 3 months of coaching me, generally once a week. But like I said, it wasn't really training. He did an assessment of me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't very pretty because all I had was engineering skills.
Yeah.
But I remember he asked, look, you can learn this stuff if you want to. But he asked me point blank, what is I willing to put in the work to learn mm-hmm. this? And I said, absolutely. I absolutely believed it was the most important thing, you know, to learn. I believed that there were two hard problems in product, figuring out the right product and building it right. And I felt like I'd spent 10 years on learning how to build it right. And it was time to learn how to build the right product.
Yeah.
And so I was very willing. And so after the assessment, he gave me some books like on finance because I didn't know anything. He gave me books on analytics. He had a finance person coach me on the KPIs mm-hmm. that were relevant for our products. So he introduced me to salespeople and how the sales organization worked and marketing. I hadn't even met these people before, let alone knew what they did. So there was a lot for me to learn. But literally in just about 3 months, I think it was just under 3 months, he said, you're ready to be a product manager. Up until then, he was very clear that I couldn't make any decisions without running them by him.
Wow. Okay. And then you became a product manager at HP?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually continued as an engineering leader and also covered product management. They let me do a dual role.
What would you say about setting up such dual roles today?
So this is what the CTPOs are.
They're
dual roles.
What do you think of this role?
Well, first of all, I think that's the future.
Yeah.
That's another discussion with AI. We're going to see a lot more of that.
Product and engineering is coming way closer to each other. Right?
But I always told people there were real synergies, and there are, but I also warned people that that's two jobs. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of hours.
Did you know when this guy said, are you willing to put the effort in? Did you have an idea how much effort it actually will be?
Yeah, but it wasn't that bad. I know that he was just saying, are you willing to put the effort to learn these skills? It wasn't that hard.
And you're saying you learned it in 3 months?
Yeah, 3 months. And I'm not, and I, I had further to climb than most people.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember he said, you can't make any decisions until you visited at least 15 customers.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted, no, he said 30 customers, 15 in the US and 15 in Europe. That was my first business trip to Europe.
Yeah, cool.
Böblingen, if I never said it right. Outside of Stuttgart, there is a...
Böblingen, yeah.
Yeah, that was, there was an HP division there. It was part of my visits, and I visited customers. Anyway, it was amazing, these customer visits, because I had not done that. I'd only visited really other...
So that were basically your first user interviews or yes. customer interviews?
Yes, and he taught me how to do those, and it was amazing.
And so, then you took notes and brought them back to the US and started to see some patterns.
And started to build products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And was like, what was this setup like? Like, you've been the engineering manager still and a product manager. So I guess it was not like flat hierarchies, cross-functional teams.
It was cross-functional teams, but I was, you know, even today, even though the Agile people don't like it, a lot of times the engineering manager is on the team.
Yeah, which is a very good concept, I do think.
It's not the end of the world. Yeah, certainly no. not the end of the
Definitely
world.
Definitely not.
So I was doing both, yeah. And remember, like, almost everybody on the team was an engineer anyway.
Yeah.
So.
What was the product, if I may ask?
The product was, this is the... So I did one product which motivated me to learn. That was ironically an AI product. An AI product from way before it was ready to be an AI product.
Okay.
But then we did a different product which was not an AI product, but it was a software development environment. You would call it an IDE today.
Ah, okay.
And that was a very successful product.
So other HP developer teams have been your customers, basically?
Well, yes, but... Initially, they were just HP employees, but then they were all HP customers, which were all over the world. I visited Deutsche Telekom, I visited FedEx, I visited, you know, BMW, all these places.
Yeah, cool. That must have been very exciting times.
Like, it was.
Being on the first business trip and stuff. Do you remember a particular moment of an early success as a product manager or product leader where you thought, like, this is how it should feel? Like, after you've described that, I'd say, frustration of 10 years of building the thing right, but not building the right thing. Like, what was the first time you ever thought, this is how it should be?
Well, I would probably... Because I had just had that coaching and I was really getting some really good advice and the timing was very good. That was a really fun and successful product that we did. It was sold for 20 years. Just
wow.
Was and it was a very interesting product too, because it was there was some terrific university technology that inspired it. And it was just one of those, you know, great product is something your customers love, but it's just now possible. And this was one of those products that was just now possible.
Mm.
And so, yeah, the customers genuinely loved it and they could do things they could never do before.
Yeah, cool, cool. And then you just said, I want to have more of these success moments.
And try to keep, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember actually that... The guy who coached me told me said something very interesting. He said, you can't guarantee home runs. You know what we mean by home runs, mm-hmm. right? Big successes.
Yeah.
Because you never know. You really never know. Mm. So, and I think that is really true.
Mm.
You can't know. You can't guarantee home runs, but he said you can guarantee you don't strike out, which is a big fail. You can guarantee, and I couldn't believe that because so many products fail.
Yeah.
And he said, if you do these things, you will not fail. You might not have a huge success, but you'll have some level of success.
Yeah.
And what were those things? Those things were basically prototype, put it in front of customers, make sure customers love it before you build the real thing. It's not like rocket science.
Yeah.
But But he, and there's techniques around this. It's called customer discovery today. These are, but I found he was right. I found that he was right, that if you do these things, you're not going to fail. They're not all like great successes, but they are reasonable successes at least. And that's doing way better than most.
Definitely. From listening to you, one could understand product management is like simple common sense. Like, what's the tricky part?
Process people. Yeah, it's amazing how process people unintentionally, really through the best of intentions, best of motivations, but unintentionally undermine innovation. Because, show me a great product, I'll show you really happy customers and a solution that was just now possible. And that's innovation. Mm-hmm. And that, the way you do that is not a recipe. It's principles.
Mm-hmm. So you cannot just copy the way other teams work because it's not guaranteeing you that even you're working on the right
you
thing.
You can't even copy the way you worked last week because what you did last week is a function of what the problems were you were trying to solve, not what you're trying to solve next week. So this is, when I was taught there are these principles that you've got to do. That's what matters. And you use those principles as appropriate based on the problem you're trying to attack. Mm. But so many people are not taught that. They're taught things like safe, or they're taught things like, you know.
Yeah, it's like when we do a daily stand-up, when we do a planning, when we do a refinement, and when we do a review, we will have a successful product.
Yeah.
That's not the case.
It's just not the case. In fact, arguably, if that's what you're focused on, well, you may have heard process is a substitute for thinking.
Yeah. And you still think thinking is important, right?
I think that's really all that's really important.
Yeah. So let's maybe touch ground on the theme of the podcast series, which is, or the season. Season is the term I was searching for. It's, by the way, the first time I do a podcast interview in English. It's challenging not to be a native speaker. And
your English is perfect, so no worries.
So let's touch ground on the topic of intuition. I know it's something you've spoken about in the past, so I'd love to hear how that plays out in your own experience. And one quote I've got from you is, product management is both an art and a science. So what does the art part look like in your daily life or in your day-to-day work today?
Well, I should clarify now. You just mentioned, normally you do this in German and now English. This is one of those discussions where the words have nuance. Mm-hmm. For example, art is nothing to do with intuition in the way, I explain these and think of these. Art is amazing. Intuition is interesting. They're different things. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about art and science, the sort of the craftsmanship of creating products is both art and science. I mean, there's design, for example, is a great example of both real principles, psychological principles on how people think and learn, and conceptual models, and also what we often call taste. But the idea that certain designs are beautiful, certain designs are make you trust where you otherwise wouldn't. So there's real art that combines with the engineering to yield an amazing product.
Yeah.
So that's great. That's a totally different thing than the role of intuition.
What is the role of intuition then?
Yeah, so that's what I think you wanted to talk about. I just want to be clear, that's different than
So what I understand is like art doesn't mean you need artists in order to build products, right?
That's true too, yes. But now back to nuance. I don't like the word intuition. okay. for what we're talking about, because I think it's
perfect statement for this.
It's misleading, is all. It's misleading. Don't get me wrong. I think there is a thing called intuition for sure. We all have it. You meet somebody on the street, you have a sense on maybe what their intentions are. Yeah. It's probably driven by intuition. Product, I believe intuition is a poor word to represent product sense. So, and product sense, intuition feels like it's something you're born with.
Mm-hmm.
Product sense, that is something we build.
Mm-hmm.
Every good product person I know builds product sense. When I coach, I'm coaching them to develop their product sense. The person who was coaching me and made me go out there and talk to customers was like, you need to build some product sense. You need to get a real understanding of your customers and the problems they have and what they're looking for in solutions. Now, once you've done that, people are like, oh, that person's amazing. Everything, you know, they decide is a good choice. And they knew this was going to happen before the rest of the world did. That's not intuition. That's product sense. They have learned and now they have knowledge that helps them predict what's going to happen.
And recognize patterns and stuff.
Yes,
so how is product sense then different from experience?
It's based on experience.
Yeah.
But I think it's experience is just kind of data.
Yeah.
And product sense is you've thought about that. You see the patterns. You can draw a line to what's probably going to happen next.
Hmm.
That's more, you know, it's on top of experience. Experience is critical. And that's why developing product sense starts by learning these things, talking to customers, learning the data, learning the market, learning the industry trends, learning the technology. We need to do this in order to build real product sense.
So you're saying we are not born with product sense? There are not people who are good product manager because they were born with
that skill? Yeah, I think that's a common myth.
Like,
And it doesn't really come from product managers, the myth. Most of the time it comes from founders.
Yeah, because they think they are Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs had that magical product sense.
So here's the thing. Those founders, the good ones, have developed product sense.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what a founder does from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They have been at every single customer visit, probably. They have done every experiment. They have seen every mistake. They have sweated over every competitor. They have studied the industry analysts. They have developed product sense. Where they get in trouble is that they don't realize that's how they got their product sense. They just think it was a gift from God.
Yeah.
And so then when they do their next startup, they're like, oh, I know what to do.
Yeah.
Everything I said was brilliant.
I just have to be inspired by God.
Yeah. And I'm like, no, that is not how it works. And you can see it. We all saw that. Like we saw Elon Musk destroy Twitter.
Yeah.
He had amazing product sense he had developed around aeronautics, around electric cars. But that did not help him with Twitter.
Yeah, maybe that's a topic we shouldn't dive too deep into. But yeah, I guess speaking about Elon Musk could fill the entire hour.
That's true.
And speaking about his craziness and the recent developments. I do have some recordings on my voicemail. Like I have an 80s answering machine where the guests from season one could ask questions. Now, I feel like I should drop all these questions because you just said intuition is like a misleading term. Maybe we're going to replace intuition with product sense. And let me start maybe with someone you know very well and has maybe a good follow-up question or maybe something we could dive deeper into. Let's give it a try.
My name is Petra Wille, and my question to you is, can you coach or train for intuition?
Let's say for product sense. Like, how do you coach or train for
product
sense?
Well, that's a perfect question, really, because it frames the thing. I think you can't really coach or train for intuition because it's, if you believe that intuition is this innate thing, but you can absolutely coach and train for product sense, which is exactly what every good coach I know does. So yes, if we take Petra at her meaning, can you develop this skill, this ability to really understand your customers, understand where things are going, to be able to use, to predict much of what you need to do? Yes, you absolutely can. I've seen it thousands of times.
Yeah. What I'm wondering is, I mean, we've all been to situations where we had like qualitative data, we had quantitative data, oftentimes speaking a very different language, or showing us very different results, which we cannot, in the end, cannot put together, like the puzzle pieces don't fit. And I feel there is always this little space, which we try to minimize by following principles, where we have to trust some gut feeling, don't you?
No, see, well, I don't frame it that way, but you're not wrong on what's going on. Think about it this way. Do you really believe that any good product person is 100% data-driven?
No.
They're not.
No.
They're not. They're data-informed.
Yeah.
The difference between data-driven and data-informed is data-driven, you don't need to think.
Yeah.
The data is somehow going to tell you what to do.
Data is going to take the decision for you.
It is. Yeah. That's not what good people do. What they do is they take their product sense, which they have developed over typically years, and they combine that with the data, which is informing a particular decision. And they use that to make a judgment. Good judgment, product sense, is helping you make good sense of the data. One of the principles that so many of the good companies do, like every good product company I know, well, they are very data informed. Absolutely. They run on data. But like at Amazon, for example, one of their leadership principles is when the anecdotes differ from the actual data, look at those anecdotes. They're telling you something.
It is a sign. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're trying to say, think.
Yeah.
Think your understanding combined with the data.
Yeah.
So yes, I think that is really important principle. And if you think of it with that framing, that a strong product sense allows you to make good decisions as new data comes up every day. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the results of a test. We have a live data test going. We look at the results. What does that really mean? What should we do? That's where if you're just data-driven, it's like, oh, well, we're canceling it or we're continuing it. That's not a useful decision. What you need to know is like, really, what should we do here? Maybe this is telling us something meaningful. Maybe it's not. Maybe we need to go talk to more people to figure out what's really going on. More thinking.
Yeah. I guess nowadays people start to feed all that data into a large language model and want that model to decide. I guess that's something you also dislike.
The people that are doing really great things with foundation models today are the ones that are thinking.
Yeah.
And the people that are just, and you know, it's, I think it was my friend Shreyas Doshi. You may know Shreyas. He's a very good product thinker. He was trying to say, look, if your belief is that you're going to make your decisions all based on data, then your job can clearly be replaced.
Yeah. But so that gives me hope that our discipline will still be needed in a couple of years.
So I have a lot of hope that the discipline is, but not as it's practiced in most of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
In most of Europe, it's a process role.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what I'm talking about, not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's a process role. Those are the first to die.
Yeah, the gatekeeper of the backlog.
Yes, those roles. I don't know when it's going to happen. I think it's already starting.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 2 years from now, 4 years from now, something like that. the product owner role is gone.
Yeah.
And it should be gone.
Yeah, yeah. I fully agree. But there is then room for a product manager role that makes actual sense. But yeah, that's all about thinking and not following
that
the
is,
process so blindfoldedly.
Yeah.
Let me let us listen to the answering machine once again.
Sure.
I see there's it's still a red blinking dot. Speaking about technology from the past, I mean, that's what we did a couple of times today already. So here's another question.
Hi, I'm Lisa Radl, and I would like to know, when hiring for a product manager, how do you make sure in an interview that somebody balances their intuition with data?
I would frame that the same way. How do we balance the two? What we're trying to do is we're if you frame it instead of intuition, because again, intuition, what does that really tell people? Just go with your gut. That's the dumbest advice you could give anybody, right? Their gut is almost certainly wrong. And so I don't like the framing it as gut. Gut is here, brain is here.
Yeah.
Right? But going with your brain is product sense. That is not gut. That's product sense. It's informed by you doing the work. If you've done the work, and this is what I interview for, right? Okay, tell me an example. First of all, I'm interviewing if they've already been a product manager. I want to see if they have developed product sense on their last product. It's not that hard to figure that out. Or do they think their job is to follow some process?
And when I answer correctly, it's like interviewing them, like, how did you develop your YaaS product? What was the way, what principles did you apply? And you're checking whether or not they've reflected what they did there.
Yes. And I'm tracking to see, like, did they really do the work? Did they, how many customers they really talked to? What did they really learn from those customers? What is their takeaway? What do they think is going to happen next in that market? You know, if they've developed the product sense, we'll see that. Yep. If they've done that sense, then they are, I want to make sure that they are doing just as the questioner implied, that you're balancing that. Because just because you have that sense doesn't mean that you're not learning every day, right? Mm. And a lot of the source of learning is data. So we've been running a test and it's surprising us. Something is wrong. We need to figure that out. Our product sense is going to end up better at the end of it, but we have to figure out what we had wrong. Mm. And that's why you need to have this both. And it's not just data, I should say, too. It's also talking to more customers. It's also following the newest technology. There are things we could do today that we literally couldn't do yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
This is all part of developing that product sense.
Yeah. I'm wondering maybe it's, again, a language nuance, but I wouldn't be so strict with the term of intuition, I realize, because for me, and I've never discussed that with a psychologist, maybe it would be a good discussion to have, because my understanding is like the human intuition also comes from having learned something, having collected experience, and like the brain doesn't build intuition because we are born with that. It's like it's something that emerges over time. Like in when we learn how to drive a car, in German there's this saying, it takes, I don't know if that makes sense in English, I give it a try. It takes you 7 years after you had your driver's license to build the seventh sense for traffic. That's all about, like, that's my understanding of intuition. Like, after 7 years driving a car, you recognize those patterns. And when a ball, you see a ball, you realize there will be a child behind that ball and you push the brakes and stuff like that.
But if everybody understood the word intuition to mean this, which is really what I've described as product sense, then it's not issue.
Yeah.
But most people
think it's just a given.
They think it's something here, not here.
Yeah, but also most people think that talent is something that's given.
That's
and,
what I mean.
And
it's
also
more like a gift
everybody
from God.
We would refer to being very talented. They put a lot of effort into
that's
it.
That's right.
Yeah. You've already mentioned AI to some degree, and that's the last topic for today I wanted to speak to you about. So let's look a little bit into the future and how AI is reshaping our craft, not by replacing product sense, but by expanding it. That's at least how I understood your recent writing as well. So I'd like to explore this topic a little bit. And what I see as one of the major disruptive innovations coming in probably just a few years ahead, it's been science fiction 10 years ago, but nowadays it becomes very tangible because, yeah, we have it to some degree already, that languages will no longer be a barrier for humans, right? We, like, in a couple of years from now, it will be just fluent to speak to someone in a foreign language, and everybody stays in their own language. And I guess that's going to be a huge disruption for mankind. I'm not yet sure if it's an utopia or dystopia. We need to see if conflicting parties will benefit from that, or if it will build more conflicts because people understand each other finally. Inspired by that thought, I was wondering, or I'm curious, what major disruptions do you expect in the upcoming years?
Well, you were just giving an example of natural language translations. Yeah. I mean, we already are seeing the new programming language that everybody's learning, which they know is English.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the questions I was wondering is, does vibe coding work just as well in German as it does in English? I don't know. All my examples have been in English, but in theory it should, right?
Yeah.
It should. There's a smaller base probably for training in other languages, but the point is we will be able to program in our natural language. That is happening. And that's, I think that's dramatic and as revolutionary as anything that's ever happened on the technology side. As far as what else, I mean, there are, as you know, I mean, there is work going on in every field right now, from medicine to manufacturing to robotics to logistics to everything. And so I think the next era will be what the term I've been using, for lack of a better term, really, is intelligent products. Intelligent products, which are both a blend of deterministic solutions, which is what we've always had. And I think we always will have as well. But what we haven't had is the probabilistic solution. Mm-hmm. And that's being introduced into so many different products today. And the results are truly intelligent products, which are something that we've wished we've had for 50 years. And now we finally are experiencing.
Yeah, and we still wish we'd have those when we speak to Alexa or Siri these days, which became very old-fashioned right now, right?
Yeah.
Old-fashioned.
Yeah, they're not quite there.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, probably. When you observe the rise of AI, and that's my approach now to connect the dots between the beginning and the end of the podcast, because as I said, it's all about the human behind the product. We spoke about your early days. So when you observe the rise of AI, do you ever feel a bit jealous of the tools and capabilities that young product managers have at their fingertips these days? Or is it rather that you feel relieved that you don't have to start your career in times like these?
Oh, honestly, mostly, I think I've been incredibly lucky. I alluded to this at the beginning of our chat, but one of the very first products I worked on was literally an AI product in 1985. Mm-hmm. I mean, so long time ago, right? 40 years ago, I worked on an AI product. And it was literally called the HP AI Workstation. And it was just so far away from the technology that needed to be. It was, we thought we were close. We were very, very far away.
So it was a feasibility risk you didn't foresee?
We thought, the technology was not there.
Yeah.
We didn't even realize just how far it was. Do you remember how it felt very much like, do you remember 10 years ago, self-driving cars were imminent?
Yeah.
If you go and ride a Waymo, it's real. But it took a while. They spent a decade doing discovery on that. So that is hard. That's what we learned too. Some things that looked like were imminent.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was literally working on automatic programming, mm-hmm. but that was much harder than it sounded.
Yeah.
Much harder. So the point is, over the last 40 years, I've watched several waves of attempts at AI. And honestly, I gave up trying to pursue those products myself because it was clear to me the technology wasn't ready until about 3 years ago. And then, as you may know, the technology changed. Neural networks became the basis of what was done, and that's where transformers came from, and that's where the models came from. And this has changed the game. So now it's real. I love that my career really started with this interest and will likely end with it being real. So I kind of feel like I had a front row seat to all of that.
Yeah.
I do think, because I started by saying I got into this because I love to create products. I don't think it's ever been easier and better time to create products.
Yeah.
So I think I like to believe that if I was just, you know, finishing school right now, that I would be one of those people at Y Combinator's AI startup school.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I feel like maybe it becomes more like making a career in the music industry, because there's so many talented musicians out there who put a lot of effort into it, but not everyone becomes Lady Gaga in the end.
Yeah.
Or the Beatles.
Right.
We had them. So it was maybe easier to become the Beatles in the 50s than it is today to become famous in the music industry. And maybe that's the same for developing digital products in the future, because there's like a lot of competition in the future when everybody has these capabilities at hand.
I honestly never thought about that analogy, but I like it, because I do think, the barriers to entry for a musician, if you can play an instrument, you know, or use your voice, you could, it's up to you. Can you create something other people want to hear? The barriers to creating products, digital tech powered products, are dropping like a stone.
Yeah.
They're dropping very rapidly. I saw a little video the other day that was amazing. It was a group of children. I mean, they looked to me about 7, 8 years old in their school, a whole bunch of them, all in front of computers. They were all vibe coding.
Yeah.
And you should have seen their joy when they got something working.
Did it remind you of the joy you felt when you started coding?
It did, but I was building trivial little things. Yeah. They're building real things.
Yeah.
And so that's a beautiful thing. So I'd like to think that I would have been one of those people. I don't know if I'd have been Lady Gaga, but I would have been, you know, somebody who like, oh, this is awesome. And hopefully I'd had the skills to stand out and develop things. I really do think, though, once those technology, you know, the barriers to entry go so low, what's left is product sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's the differentiator.
Yeah.
Can you really see and understand what people need and see what it's going to take to solve their problems?
Yeah, I like that thought very much. And it's a very nice final statement. So I have just two questions to round up our conversation and to finish that episode of the Product Mansion podcast. And the first one is, which question do you not get asked enough but would love to answer?
I'm probably a terrible person to ask that to, because I get thousands of questions.
Yeah.
I rarely get new questions, and yeah. I rarely get, and if a question is not asked, but I think it's important, I write about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm probably not a good one for that.
So what is the question you're most annoyed of?
Oh, that's different. That's, yeah. I mean,
because you get asked it like every time.
I get lots of questions, which immediately, you know, when somebody asks a question, it does reveal a lot about where they're coming from,
yeah.
what they know, what they don't know. And a lot of people, it's clear they have not done any learning about our space. You know, they clearly don't understand the difference between discovery and delivery. They don't understand the difference between what a good product manager is supposed to do and what a product owner does. And so there's a lot of these are just very, you know, basic questions.
Yeah. Which I personally like, because it tells me that there is still some work to do for us product coaches. So last question, what advice would you give to someone who's unsure whether or not they can trust their product sense already?
I would tell them what all the time, test it. So what do you think is a good solution? Prototype that solution. Never been easier to do. Put it in front of customers, see. You will know pretty quickly if you're, you know, got a good sense for this
or
not. If
you have the right sense.
And if you don't, you'll learn. These are all part of the work to learn. So it can be, as long as you keep an open mind and keep at it, it's self-correcting.
Yeah. So it's all about build, measure, learn.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being on the show today, Marty. It's been a pleasure speaking to you and a very big honor for this little podcast, which probably will become a bit bigger after this episode gets published.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I hope it was useful and I enjoyed the chat.
That was the first episode of the new season. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did and that it gave you some new ideas to take away with you. All links and references can be found in the show notes as always. If you liked this episode and want to support this tiny little podcast, then please subscribe to it in your favorite podcast app, give it a 5-star rating and recommend it to a friend or a colleague. You may also want to subscribe to the newsletter at productmention.de to stay up to date on upcoming guests and behind-the-scenes news. For feedback or ideas, feel free to write to feedback@productmention.de. And if you'd like to receive more content from me or stay in touch, simply follow Tobias Freudenreich on LinkedIn. Last but not least, you may want to know who's next on the show. Well, I cannot reveal that right now. But I do have a gut feeling that after Marty, someone called Martin would be a good fit. Don't you agree? Thanks for listening. I hope you tune in again in 2 weeks when we continue with episode 2. See you then.
This episode of the Product Mention podcast was proudly presented by Hey Clarity. We help company leaders build strong product organizations. Find out how we can help you at hey-clarity.com.